thank you all so much for coming. My name's Lee Walton. I'm the head of marketing for Top Shelf Productions, the publishers of March. And and you're not here to see me. So I'll keep it very brief. It has been a tremendous honor for everyone involved with this project to be involved with this project at every step of the way. It's been many years in the making. We're not done yet. And this is just another milestone on the journey. Thank you so much for being here and sharing it with us. What can I say about Congressman John Lewis? He is a living legend and an icon in America. Life. I won't go into the details, but I will note that it is a special pleasure that after joking about it for many years and then realizing it was not a joke, Congressman Lewis has gotten into the spirit of Comic-Con, and he is in costume. Of the trench coat and the backpack that he wore that day in Selma 50 years ago on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Joining Congressman Lewis is his co-author on the book, my dear friend, and one of the key pillars of this whole project, Andrew Iden. Andrew, of course, without you, none of this would have been remotely possible. And thank you for everything that you've done so far and that you will continue to do. And last but certainly not least, award-winning artist, another dear friend of mine. I love him like a brother. In fact, your mom once said that I was officially your brother, so. The incredible, the incomparable Nate Powell, the artist of Marvel. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the stars of the show, especially Congressman John Lewis.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're a good-looking group. Beautiful, handsome. Thank you for being here. Lee, thank you for your kind words of introduction. Thank you for all you've done to get us to this point. Notice, Lee, this is my second time at Comic-Con. And I'm happy to be here. It is good to be here. I don't even know where to start. But I want to tell you that I'm more than lucky, I'm very blessed to be working with Andrew Iden, who's on my staff. But he's not working on the staff, he's writing and researching. Working on Marge, book one, now book two. And there will be book three that he's working on right now. Being here with Nate Powell, this unbelievable artist, he can make the word jump off the pages and sing a song. these two young men, like Lee, but like brothers. It was Andrew who had this idea, and he would tell the story, and I shouldn't step on his message and let him tell the story. He had the idea that we should do a graphic novel, or some of you may call a coloring book. But as a young boy growing up in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy, when I was growing up, I saw the signs that said, colored waiting, white waiting, colored men, white men, colored women, white women. Growing up there, we would go downtown to the theater. All of us little black children had to go upstairs to the balcony. And all the little white children went downstairs to the first floor. I would come home and ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why? They would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. I heard a Rosa Parks. I heard the words of Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio. The action of Rosa Parks, the words and leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. inspired me to find a way to get in the way, to get in trouble. I got in trouble, what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. We are hoping the March, book one, but also book two, and when book three come out, will inspire another generation of young people and people not so young to stand up, to speak up and speak out and get in good trouble. I want to thank the teachers and all of the students, all of these beautiful young children for being here. I remember when I was 4 years old, my father had saved $300 and bought 110 acres of land that we still own today. On this farm, there is a lot of cotton and corn, peanuts, hogs, cows, and chickens. And some of you have been reading the chicken story? You know it better than I do, right? But sometime out there working in a hot field, in a hot sun, I would fall behind. And my mother would say, boy, you're falling behind. You need to catch up. And I would say, this is hard work. And she would say, hard work never killed anybody. I said, well, it's about to kill me. So I spent a lot of time on that farm caring for the chickens and raising the chickens. And as a little child, I became very good at raising chickens. Now, any of you young people know anything about raising chicken? Some of you like to eat chicken, right? But you don't know anything about raising chicken. As a little boy, I had to take the fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under the setting hen, and wait for 3 long weeks for the little chicks to hatch. Some of you may be saying, now John Lewis, why don't you mark the fresh egg with a pencil before you place them under the setting hen? Well, from time to time, another hen would get on that same nest. There would be some more fresh eggs. Had to be able to tell the fresh eggs from the eggs that were already under the setting hen. Do you follow me? You don't follow me. It's okay. It's all right. We're never quite able to save $18.98 to order the most inexpensive incubator, a hatchet from the Cicero Buck store. We used to get the Cicero Buck catalog, so it was a big book, heavy book. Some people call it the wish book. I wish I had this, I wish I had that. But I just kept on wishing. But as a little child, I wanted to be a minister. I wanted to preach the gospel. So from time to time, with the help of my brothers and sisters and cousins, we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard, like you would gather here in this hall. And the chickens, along with my brothers and sisters and cousins, would help make up the audience, the congregation. And I would start speaking or preaching, and when I look back on it, some of these chickens would bow their heads. Some of these chickens would shake their heads. They never quite said amen. But I'm convinced that some of those chickens that I preached to in the 40s and the 50s tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listen to me today in the country. I was so inspired by Dr. King and Rosa Parks that I met Rosa Parks in 1957 when I was 17. The next year, in 1958, at the age of 18, I met Martin Luther King Jr. And I got involved in the American Civil Rights Movement. We studied the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. Went on to sit-in. But when Book 2 stood off, it's the Freedom Ride of 1961. And that's what I want to talk about for a moment. And I'm going to leave the rest to Andrew and to Nate. Just think, in 1961, if you were living in Washington, D.C., or traveling from Washington, D.C., through Virginia, through North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, on the way to New Orleans, black people and white people couldn't be seated together on the bus. Couldn't be seated together in a restaurant, at a lunch counter, at a Greyhound bus station, a Trailway bus station. Couldn't use the same restroom facilities. 1961 was the same year that President Barack Obama was born. A group of us made a decision to test a decision of the United States Supreme Court. 13 of us, African American and white, met in Washington, D.C. on May 1st, 1961. Went through training. The night of May 3rd, we went down to a Chinese restaurant in downtown Washington, D.C. Growing up in rural Alabama, going to school in Nashville, Tennessee, I never been to a Chinese restaurant, never had Chinese food. And that night, while we were eating, someone said, "You should eat well. This may be like the last supper." It was an unbelievable meal, delicious meal. The next day, May 4th, 1961, we left Washington, D.C. And in Charlotte, North Carolina, the first incident occurred when a young African-American man tried to get a shoe shine in a so-called white barbershop. He was arrested and taken to jail. The next day, he went before a jury. The jury dismissed the charges. On May 9th, 1961, my seatmate, a young white gentleman, the two of us tried to enter a so-called white waiting room in Rock Hill, South Carolina, about 35 miles from Charlotte, North Carolina. A group of young men attacked us. Members of the Klan beat us and left us lying in a pool of blood. The local police officials came up, wanted to know whether we wanted to press charges. We said no, we believe in the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. Many years later, to be exact, February 09, one of the gentlemen who had attacked us came to my office in Washington. He was in his 70s. His son was in his 40s. And he said, "Mr. Lewis, I'm one of the members of the Klan who beat you and beat your seatmate. I want to apologize. Will you forgive me?" I said, "I accept your apology. I forgive you." His son started crying. He started crying. They hugged me. I hugged him back, and I started crying. It says something about the power of the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence, the power of the way of peace, the way of love. March, book 1 and book 2 and book 3 would tell the story. That we must create a society at peace with itself. That we lay down the burden of hate, the burden of division, the burden of separation. And we want another generation of young people. It was the children, it was the young people who led a non-violent revolution in America during the 60s. And we can do it again. We must do it again. The future of our country, the future of this little piece of real estate, the future of our society, maybe the future of this planet, will be determined by the young. And that's why I'm so grateful to all of the students, all of the young people, and all of the teachers that are teaching March. Saying, find a way to get in the way. Find a way to get in good trouble, necessary trouble. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, do something about it. Yes, I'm wearing a backpack today. A trench coat. Have 2 books in it. An apple. Toothpaste and toothbrush. What I had on March 7, 1965. Almost died on that bridge. I thought I saw death. But I'm still here. And I will not give up. I will not give in. And you must not give up. You must not give in. Speak up. Speak out, and let's bring about a non-violent revolution in America again. Thank you very much.
Secretary. And now I'm experiencing March. And this is unlike anything I ever thought it would be. Some of you may at one point ask yourself, why would John Lewis write a graphic novel? Well, it's my fault. We were on the campaign in 2008. It's coming down to the end of it. Folks were saying, what are you going to do? Somebody's going to go to the beach. Somebody else is going to see their parents. I was going to a comic book convention. And when I said that, as you can imagine, these uptight political folks laughed at me. But not John Lewis. From the back of the room, I heard John Lewis say, don't laugh. There was a comic book during the movement, and it was incredibly influential. That comic book was Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story. And after I read it, it seemed self-evident to me that it was time for John Lewis to write his own comic book. So I started asking, John Lewis, why don't you write a comic book? I was 24, I didn't know anybody. He said, oh, maybe? Which is a very nice way of a politician telling you no. But I'm stubborn. If I believe in an idea, I don't give up on it. And I kept asking, because we would sit there and we would talk. This is a summer of hope and change. Barack Obama sweeping through the primaries, and all of a sudden everybody's wondering, how do we reach young people? They're not trying to find that one issue that splits 5% of the vote one way or the other. They want to expand the electorate for the first time in 25 years. So how do we reach young people? Well, I have an idea. I think you should write a comic book. Shut up, kid. How do we teach nonviolence to a new generation? Because even if we get Barack Obama elected, if we don't give them a Congress with pressure, then we're not going to get anything done. Why did you write a comic book about that? Finally, he said, okay, I'll do it. But only if you write it with me. And that moment changed my life. I went on to write my graduate thesis about Martin Luther King, the Montgomery story, because I was so fascinated with the idea that a comic book could actually be used in the civil rights movement. And what we found was that it was more than just used, it was incredibly widely distributed, and it was responsible for some of the earliest acts of civil disobedience of the movement. And perhaps more importantly to what the congressman and I were trying to do, we found out that Martin Luther King Jr. himself was a comic book editor. Right, we found the letter shortly after his first son was born. He sent some notes. And lo and behold, every one of those notes ended up in the final version of the script. Now to me, as I was pouring through March, working on grad school, this idea of Dr. King in 1957 sitting at a table reading a comic book script gave me a deep sense of comfort. We were not alone. Now, 2 years ago when I was here, I said something to you. I asked, how many of you watched Battlestar Galactica? All of this has happened before, and all of this will happen again. It is very unfortunate how right I was. As we look around the country today, we see a nonviolent revolution taking place. It's in its nascent stages, and we don't have SNCC yet. But we're getting there. We have something called the nine-word problem. That's what Nate and I have come to call it. Kids graduate from college or high school, and they know 9 words about the civil rights movement. They don't understand nonviolence, but they know Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, and I Have a Dream. And that's how the South was desegregated. Unfortunately, that is not the case. It was a sacrifice of a number of individuals who were willing to risk everything, many of whom had to give their lives for the reality that we are now watching slip away. But we're changing that. March is being used in schools in more than 40 states. This fall, nearly a dozen major universities around the country will have March as their freshman reading book, oftentimes the first graphic novel they've ever used. Not only are we breaking down barriers of the civil rights movement, but we're breaking down barriers for comics, too. So let's just say for a moment that we teach nonviolence to every young person in this country. Let's say that, as I got a phone call just before book one came out from a reporter at a conservative newspaper that shall remain nameless, who said, I gave your book to my 9-year-old son. I don't usually do that. But now he's gone, he's put on his Sunday suit, he's marching around my house, he's demanding equality for everyone. So let's see if we can get this in every 9-year-old's hands. It's up to you. Congressman and I are on the road. We're traveling, we're writing, we're speaking. Nate's gone there. Nate's drawing his little heart out. He's got 2 kids. He's a busy man. I have a dog. It's as much as I can handle. So where do we start? Where do we start this journey? Where do we win our first victory? Well, we just won one down in South Carolina. Yeah. Bree Newsom committed a textbook nonviolent act. She followed the exact methodology that you would use. She outlined her plan. She recorded it. She accepted the consequences. And now I believe it's time that the charges should be dropped. So where do we go from here? We need an activist generation. We need it more than we even know. But we got to start with student loans. It's time for public education in this country to be free. You want to know why we don't have an activist generation? It's because they're at work paying their student debt. Country aren't growing. When they had the March on Washington, they called for a minimum wage that is the equivalent of $15 an hour today. $15 an hour. So when you put it in the context of the debate, and you want to tell me that Dr. King's dream has been realized, I say malarkey. Thank you, Joe Biden. But we're a Comic-Con. This is a sacred space. For those of us who I bought Uncanny X-Men 317 for the first time. It was given me by my grandmother. She bought it off a spinner rack at a Piggly Wiggly in Western North Carolina. And I still have it. And so when we come here, we don't just remember who we are. We remember that this is a safe space. This is a place where we can all come from walks of life that maybe in other parts of our lives we wouldn't encounter each other. Different incomes, different races, different geographies. This is the beloved community. And that's why I love it. I'll tell you one story, and then I'll finish. When I was a kid, I brought comic books to school. And my teacher said, those aren't real books, put them away. Well, I had the opportunity to go back to my school. With Congressman Lewis. Discuss their experiences teaching out books. I don't say that as any form of comeuppance to the teacher. She's doing the Lord's work. I say that to highlight the power of an idea whose time has come. In a few short years, comics went from pariahs to the bedrock of the future of education in some ways. So I ask you all, join us. March. Thank you.
Through the process of working on March Book One, not only were we learning what our strengths and responsibilities were, but we were understanding in real time how our collaborative process was going to work. And by the time book one was finished, we had arrived at a point in which we were comfortable with a certain kind of balance, and we had to move through a lot of issues along the way, but we smoothed things out to the point that March book two, from a process standpoint, was a completely different creature. I feel like, importantly, we were able to hit the ground running. And as not only as the demands of the book as a physical entity changed, but as the demands of this account of history and this account of Congressman Lewis's personal perspective on history involved more people, involved an escalation of events, of consequences, but also a lot more accountability to that end. We were able to spend a lot more time, a lot more necessary time, making sure that that side of the bookmaking and storytelling process was covered. And I feel like we worked in a very smooth, very organic way. The considerations for working on March were constantly, or they are constantly threefold. I feel like we have to do a lot of considerations for it as a comic, as a work of art. And, you know, it feels really good to know that by the time book two was finished, I'm like, I think this is the best thing I've ever drawn. And I never normally feel like that when I finish a book. I'm always like, well, I guess it's done. I can't fix anything else because it has to be at the printer in like 35 minutes. I was like, all right, we did it. We really did it this time. Also, considerations with March as history. It's very, I think, speaking just for me, it's easy to forget how even when the book dropped, when book one dropped, you know, not a single student had it in school. It wasn't in any libraries. And I've been publishing on Top Shelf for 10 years, and I knew that it was going to be bigger than any book I had been involved with. But none of us had any idea exactly what that meant. And I think we were really like rolling and evolving amongst ourselves and dealing with the public and the industry and everything in response to the demands of the book. It's also been interesting because, you know, March is in, you know, institutional settings. It's in schools in over 40 states. It's in libraries everywhere. Not only does it face challenges as a book, but, you know, like, once it's embedded itself in so many history classes that it's actually, you know, we fought and worked to meet particular standards, provide teacher's guides so that it was virtually incontestable to argue that it should be, you know, accepted as a historical document as well as a memoir, as well as a comic, as well as a work of art. But once it is accepted as a historical document, it opens up this whole other book of challenges where not only are you really making sure you're accountable and responsible, but, for example, in March Book 2, as the movement builds and expands far beyond the scope of smaller, isolated groups of people, you know, we had to have a lot of discussions amongst ourselves. You know, certain events that a young John Lewis was not physically present for. For example, the bombing of his bus outside of Anniston, Alabama. A young John Lewis had left Freedom Ride for a couple of days to interview for a social program that was going to be happening in India. He decided to turn it down ultimately, that his work was at home in the South. But as he was returning to the Freedom Ride, he received the news that the bus had been firebombed and all the occupants had been attacked. And so there would be discussions throughout the book in these incidents in which the narrator, the first-person perspective, was not present at the moment, what an appropriate and responsible depiction of these events would be. And in that case, kind of what March really was as a story. There are also moments in which it's been amazing. You know, we've had chances not only to bring a couple of new things to light in the historical record, but also sort of as a challenge to the fact that people are reading this as history. We've even had an opportunity or two to kind of set straight a couple of like small to medium-sized errors that we find in a couple of different historical documents or books. And I don't know, we've had to have very active discussions along the way at every step there. In the same way that, you know, a story is a living thing, history itself is a living thing. It's been very exciting to see that work in real time. Now, I'm from Arkansas. I also grew up, spent my elementary school years in Montgomery, Alabama, and my family is all from northern Mississippi. I was born in the 70s, at the tail end of Generation X, and in terms of, on a personal level, the ways in which not only discussions with my family have really shifted and evolved. You know, my parents are cool, y'all. But you know, my parents have certainly grown a lot in between, like their perspective on growing up in and through the Jim Crow South. You know, from the time I was a child to now, the way we're able to discuss it and the way they reflect upon it now. But it's on a personal level, it's just been amazing since the first two books of March have come out. Book two just like really rocked my mom's world, especially like, you know, growing up of my generation with baby boomer, southerner, white middle class parents, I grew up with a basic working knowledge of the civil rights movement and of the segregated South, but it always came with a punctuation that it was a different time. And it kind of like snipped off any more complicated discussion of what a lot of these issues meant. It was always kind of ironing into me, like, whatever they would say, but it was a different time. And so as I grew through my teens and my 20s, a lot of that kind of echoed as BS, you know? And what's been exciting about working on March is, while that is true, it's been a life changer just to be able to speak and work with you, Congressman, and whenever you are telling your story privately or publicly, to really feel it when you say, you want to tell me about how things haven't changed in the last 50 years or 40 years, why don't you come walk in my shoes? And I hear it, I internalize it, and I know what that means now. So like, to feel my parents be able to speak now about their complicity in the Jim Crow South, even with limited awareness, you know, based on their place in life and their particular privileges they lived through in Mississippi, you know, it's been amazing on a personal and professional level. Also, you know, as a Southerner, I gotta say, like, it's kind of rocked my world this year. Like, I never thought I would see the Confederate flag actually be taken down from public institutions in my lifetime. Possible way and in the worst possible ways, you know? So as March continues to grow and build, you know, as a comic and as a form of expression and storytelling, but also as a tool for teaching and learning, it's been an exciting and very, very difficult challenge to kind of own up to the role we play in that expanding, necessary, broader conversation. As the artist, I feel like one of my roles is to look in between the lines of the script, to look for very subjective moments of nuance, doubt, terror, try to pull out emotional qualities that can't be sort of fit into the who, what, why, where, when of the moments. But most importantly, I feel like removing the level of abstraction that we have when we're kind of reckoning with history. Some of that has to do with always looking at grainy black and white footage, you know, and the way that, in some ways, that always has this mental block where it seems like a different world, even though some of this is like 10 years before I was born. And, you know, 10 years ago was 2005. You know, that's nothing. And I understand that now as a 37-year-old, you know. But to understand that, like, these are young people. I remember what it's like to be 21. And so allowing myself to really feel myself in a young John Lewis's shoes and understand, as a reader, even as I'm drawing it, as a reader, what it means if I were 21 in your shoes, what it means to be 16 and be taking certain risks, what it means to be 6 and have certain convictions that are shaping you as you're growing and living. So I have two kids. One's 3.5 years old. One is just 4 months old. And when my newest little baby was just a day old and we were waiting to get out of the hospital, That was March 7th. That was the 50th anniversary of the Selma March. It was just this really beautiful moment to be in the hospital. We were waiting for the release papers, but to have the entire complete family unit watching my friend John Lewis speak at the steps of the Pettus Bridge, and to be a part of telling his story and bringing it back out into the world was just this profound full circle moment. And then a couple days later, you know, then you come home and then you're like, oh, babies suck. So a few days later, the baby was like, no, I hate everything. My toddler was like, what's wrong, Daddy? I'm ready to play. It's 4 in the morning. So I had taped Congressman Lewis speaking with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. I hadn't gotten to see it yet because I went to bed at like 7:30 p.m. I was like, I'll see you guys later. But, you know, I was like, okay, kids, come on, we're going downstairs. I was like, Harper, first off, John Lewis is the only human being for whom my daughter knows their first and last name. She's like, oh, it's John Lewis. Are you going to see John Lewis and Andrew? So I was like, do you want to see John Lewis talk about our book on the TV? She's like, yeah, Daddy. And so we, all three of us, sat down on the couch at like 5 in the morning. I was like, all right, here we go. And, you know, she's grown up exposed to all these images as I'm drawing them, whether it's the evidence, the documentation, or just my pages. And it's been amazing to see her kind of accepting this historical context with her toddler brain, you know. But the most profound moment I've had so far being involved with March was watching Jon Stewart and his team had assembled a photo and video montage leading into Congressman Lewis's interview that included like the famous photo with the standoff between the Alabama state troopers and protesters with Congressman Lewis in the front. And my daughter really was absorbing it, and all of a sudden, you know, this air came over her, and with so much conviction, just in a very raw way, she was like, the policemen are being mean, keeping John Lewis and his friends from walking down the street. They're fighting John Lewis, Daddy. And she was really disturbed by this. And it really hit me hard in terms of, like, you know, everything is so complicated, but to be able to cut through all of the residual layers and all the complications, she was able to see straight to the heart of everything. And it was, you know, her sense of injustice and her sense of fairness was so crystal clear. It was like a sword. And it just made everything more important than ever before. So anyway, that's all. I'm going to continue to be teary over now.
So much. We're going to take some questions if we have time. And if we can, have some of the kids go first, if any of the kids have questions that they would like to ask, or any teachers that are in the audience. Please, young gentleman there, get the mic. If you can speak into the mic if possible.
How long did it take for you to write March?
2008 to now. No, we're not done yet. But great question.
Which contemporary social issues do you think are most important for us to deal with?
Okay. Where do I start? Higher ed. I think access to education, as well as the cost of education, is the single greatest burden that we face. And it's going to trickle into other parts of the economy. This generation can't buy houses because they're paying their student loan debt. That's going to depress the housing market. Oh, we said this to the New York Federal Reserve when we were talking about March. The first time I'm pretty sure they'd ever seen a comic book in there. And then they agree. I mean, they're putting out a report talking about how student loan debt is over $1 trillion, is the second largest consumer credit market in the country, behind mortgage debt. And that it's actually one of the biggest threats to our economy. And that's the economic side. That's not the moral side, which is where I'm coming from. And I think once you get past that, you really have to deal with with all the injustice that leads to, whether it's racial, socioeconomic. It's a broad base. I mean, there's so many places for you to start. It's really, where do you want to start?
Well, there are many, many issues that we need to confront. I happen to think that in America right now, we're just too silent. We need to make some noise. We need to speak up and speak out. I think we got to fix the voting rights issue. Make it easy and simple for everybody to register and vote. We got to do something about comprehensive immigration reform.
Yeah. Right.
And reading March, learning the stories of the past, the techniques and tactics, embracing the philosophy of nonviolence will help us move to that point. It doesn't make sense in a country like ours to have more than 11 to 12 million people living in the shadow. It's not right. It's not fair, and it's not just. I take the point there's no such thing as an illegal human being. We all come from some other place.
We share a lot of perspectives. In brief, I guess, like, a lot of my stuff is informed by growing up, becoming socially aware through underground punk rock, and so I don't know. I'm personally a lot more invested, also from certain parts of my personal life, invested in services and protections for folks with developmental disabilities and basically invisible underclasses. Another invisible class being, you know, fixing mass incarceration issues and for-profit prison. There are a million things just messed up with the world we live in, so I don't want to keep, you know, lovey-blueing. But I think we each have points that hit us in particular ways, and I feel like we're able to funnel a lot of that anger and energy and hope into the same project together at the very least. So those are some of the things that light my fire a little bit.
Thank you.
Well, on March 7, 1965, some of the people that were beating us on the bridge as we tried to walk from Selma to Montgomery had the image of the Confederate battle flag on their helmet. I see it as a symbol of division, a symbol of separation, it's a symbol of hate. We are the United States of America. As I said before, we all live in the same house, the American house. The flag is not a symbol of one house. It's a symbol of a divided house.
Thanks, man.
Our last question, and then after that we'll actually we're going to I'll explain after this question.
Hi, thank you all very much for all your work over these past 2 years. I'm Professor Andrew Davis. I teach at UCSD. I'm a filmmaker, so first, Mr. Lewis, I just want to say thank you very much for supporting Ava DuVernay with the film Selma. There was a lot of work to do. Johnson, and it was unnecessary because those same comments are not leveled at other filmmakers who had Academy Awards the same year. So I just want to say thank you from Black Independent Filmmakers for supporting us. You did more than you ever can imagine. I taught March 1. I'm going to try to get the courage to teach March 2. March 2 is very difficult for me. Every time I read March 2, I have to stop because I keep crying. Because the stories are so incredible. My question to the three of you is, could you please give me some words of encouragement or just some ideas about how I might approach the teaching of two? Because in one, we have the view over the chicken story and then the chicken stories and the events that lead up to it. But with two, it's incident after incident. So it's going to be tough. I'm going to try to balance it out, but I just want to get some thoughts of what you all think about how it would be best to approach that with both university students and my daughter's third grade class here. Mr. Reagan has been a wonderful teacher to guide his students as well.
Well, I'm not a teacher.
Yes, you are.
I must tell you, I'm so grateful to teachers. Hadn't been for teachers, I don't know what would have happened to a poor child like myself. Growing up in rural Alabama, attending a one-room school, elementary school, I had a teacher who said to me over and over again, read, my child, read. And I tried to read everything. We have very few books in our home. Just do it. You know, sometimes going back, just looking at the drawings, the illustration, it's so powerful to see these many years later, to reflect and think about how people treated people simply because they wanted to be seated together, use the same restroom facility. You seated in the same waiting room. And what happened to people? Just innocent young people, innocent students and adults, teachers, religious leaders, just trying to say, let's desegregate our means of transportation. People beat them. People left them left bloody, unconscious. Some people never recovered from the beating. Oh, I don't know how many of you read book two yet, but how people were treated, you have to tell the story. You can't sugarcoat history. It's real. The words, but Nate Powell has the unbelievable ability and capacity to just make it real. The way we were treated in Parchment. That you had black and white people arrested together, but you get to the city jail, the county jail, or to the state penitentiary at Parchment, we're separated. We were treated less than inhuman. You have to tell that. And I think most young people will understand.
Whenever,
go ahead, Nate.
Well, I was just going to say just two quick things. When we're discussing the structure of the saga, constantly we refer to it in a Star Wars context, and I think it might actually be valuable to know that like we are always thinking about Book Two as The Empire Strikes Back, and I think in response to your question, I think there is some real potential or power in being able to be like, well, like, you're like, this is a dark tome right here.
Yeah.
And but to be able to understand, even from a narrative perspective, you know, like, it's weird to kind of Yeah, to be caught up in that, but to be like, this is the account of the Empire striking back. And also, as the visual storyteller on this, in order to cope with a lot of that brutality, verbally and physically, one of the things that I upped with book two was subtly changing some of the camera angles so that the reader is the perpetrator of violence in a lot of cases. You're behind fists that are in people's faces, and that really makes it uncomfortable. But I think to point that out allows you one more step of distance to be able to absorb it and process it. I think like we have a hard time accepting, you know, because we believe in John Lewis and his peers and what they're doing. We have a hard time being put in the position of them beating and humiliating these people. But I think we did that on purpose. But highlighting it might help kind of that transition a bit.
Thank you.
And I think we have to stop before it's done.
Well, we now have a special treat. The folks with the cameras may want to go ahead and start heading out into the hall. We're going to ask all of you, if you would, to march with us. Starting with the kids, if you stay in your seats for the moment, have the kids come up and join the authors of March. We're going to head out into this hallway, and then there's a signing of the book as soon as we get down there. If you can follow with us as we go through the hall, down the stairs, to the top shelf booth in 1721. Thank you so much for coming.